Campus FM presents Treasures from Malta. This episode was originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series, produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. Hello and welcome to Treasures from Malta, a podcast series produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. I am Francesca Balzan, an art historian and an artist with a long connection with Patrimonio. I'll be presenting this podcast and meeting some of Malta's living treasures. These treasures are artists, historians or art collectors with some Malta connection. They're all fair game for the pod and we want to share them with you. My guest today is synonymous with archives. She is a well-published historian who achieved distinction throughout her academic journey and now, in turn, fires up her students with enthusiasm for the past. She has wowed us with her many discoveries, her incredible, infectious passion for the past, but most of all, her almost militant attitude to combat neglect and defend archives and their collections with extraordinary zeal. Her conviction about preserving at all costs in the face of, let's face it, a laissez-faire attitude when it comes to paper heritage has grown and grown. Several have joined her crusade, and she now counts on a team of volunteers and professionals who follow a common ideal that she has set. For her commitment to saving archives and preserving collections, she has been honored by the state, and her name has become a household name, thanks to her constantly finding ways to keep paper heritage in the news. Spend a few minutes with my guest, and invariably the conversation will fall upon archives and their plight. I've rarely seen people who are left unswayed by a short exposure to this incredible guest of mine today. Joanna Bella, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Francesca. I am humbled by this introduction. I'm so delighted to be with you today. And I am really honored that you have asked me for this friendly chat.
Joan, we live in a fast-paced, forward-looking world. Why is history and looking back still important?
This is an interesting question, because every subject of study needs a justification, and what we get out of history is less tangible than that what we get out of other disciplines. Let me give you an example, Fran. A medical doctor cures people, but the results of studying history are invisible. Mm-hmm. Many parents tell their children, this is not a profession from which you will gain much, you know, financial rewards. Why are you choosing history? Mm. Which is really a shame. Well, everything around us, everything we do has a history. So history surrounds us. It is a storehouse of information. But most importantly, Fran, history is the laboratory of the past. And that is such a beautiful, you know, thought.
Why do you say laboratory? In a laboratory, you can change things. We can't change the past.
But you can analyze. Mm-hmm. In a laboratory, you can analyze. And this is what history gives us. It gives us the opportunity to analyze, interpret the past, and through this interpretation, hopefully, all right, build a better future. And that is why history is so important. But history also gives us our identity, be it personal, national, mm-hmm. or global. So, because history is the study of human actions, which we, as historians, as I said, analyze and try to interpret, this is obviously a very important aspect, and it should be also a very important subject in our educational system, which, unfortunately, I believe, is very much underestimated. It has been relegated to a mere few hours in the social studies. And I think this is not the way forward to have a more enriched, culturally enriched people, society. But again, the study of history is important because it helps us to develop a critical mind and ask questions. And what are historians? They are supposed to be unbiased critical thinkers. So this makes us, okay, this develop a much more informed view of the world, of current affairs, in a world where we are being, you know, constantly given all this news 24/7, our society needs critical thinkers because we need to question what is going on, why it is going on, so that those in power are made accountable to their actions. And this is very important. And that is why education is often the target of dictators.
Quite right. Talking about education, you obviously have a great passion in history. It shines through whenever you speak about history, which is practically all the time. If we had to go back in your own personal history, you started your academic studies in history as a mature student in the year 2000. And I remember this well because I had just started my own studies in history of art and we had some lectures in common. And that's when we became friends. You were then a mother of three young children and you were also holding down a full-time job. Tell us about this remarkable journey of yours.
I was always fascinated by history and I think it's something which I got from my father, who was an avid reader of history books. So I was surrounded, at home I was surrounded from a young age with history and, you know, images and that sort of thing. And although I basically did my A-levels, I never continued for tertiary education, which was something which I thought was a void inside of me. My husband ultimately set up his own firm and I used to help him administer things like payroll and human resources, and that got me in contact with a lot of university students. And I think this ignited again that spark in me, because they used to talk about, you know, their experiences at university. And I said, I have something, Mrs. I want to make that experience. And at 38, with three young children, you know, 1 8, 1 10, and 1 11, I decided, listen, I'll take the plunge. If I don't succeed, well, you know, I won't be hurting anybody. I will still keep continuing helping out at my husband's business. So I tried to juggle with everything, which is quite an impossible task, mind you. But it seems that the more you try to be elastic with time, the more time you find. Nowadays, I look back and I say, how did I manage to do that? But things are manageable. If you really work hard, if you really want something, you actually go for it, you believe in yourself. And I also wanted to be a sort of like role model for my children. I used to see them studying, work hard, and, you know, they used to get nervous, and at times they used to also feel like they're not going to accomplish what they set out to do. And I said, look, if I sit down and I myself do these things, perhaps I'll serve as an inspiration for them. Why not? Things weren't easy, not at all. But I managed.
And yet you sailed through your BA studies, you then went on to read for an MA and obtained a distinction, of course, and then your PhD studies, which we'll come to later. Now, I've said that your name is synonymous with archives, but most especially the notarial archives. Tell me why this archive in particular, and what drew you to it?
Yes, that's also quite an interesting question, because few people know that when I started off to choose the topic for my undergrad thesis, actually it was something completely different and not from primary sources like notarial archives. In fact, I was going to do a study on Mediterranean tourism in the 60s, which was the boom, you know, of tourism after the Second World War. And Malta was again, being born a new nation, so it was such an interesting, but there were hurdles along the way, and I decided to change And I wanted to do a drastic change, just, you know, to cut myself off from the first choice. So I decided to approach Mr. Charles Tully, who said, yes, Joan, of course, you can choose a Moteir volume. The only thing that perhaps might hamper you is that they are in Latin.
I'll just interrupt you for a second. Mr. Tully is a noted medievalist, a historian within the Department of History in the Faculty of Arts at University.
Yes, yes. And he encouraged me. And I started lessons in basic Latin. I mean, I'm not a, you know, classical Latin reader, but, you know, I know enough just to decipher words here and there from documents. And I set out to actually start exploring the notarial archives, and at the time the only registers available, readily available, I mean, were those at the head office, because the notarial archives have two buildings, so it's the main office and another repository, which is the one at St. Christopher Street in Valletta. So I went to the main office, and when unfortunately for the time being I ran out of sources, I needed to go to the other archive. And, you know, like, then there was no turning back. It was an archive that was not accessible. It was almost impossible to do an appointment, to fix an appointment, which is ultimately honored and kept. You would go there and nobody would turn up, and then you would go back to the head office and they would tell you, we're short of staff, so we're sorry, we couldn't be there to open up. So
it's essentially, it was a storehouse of archives with these registers, which were thick volumes full of old documents of notaries.
Exactly. It's a storehouse, and the thing is that you have, you know, shelves after shelves of these volumes, one next to the other. And as soon as I went into that archive the first time, and I literally started walking on history, there were papers, you know, sprawled all over. Like, and I just browsed around, and you see the spine of the volumes and the dates, 1540, 1570, and automatically you start thinking, my God, this is the period of King Henry VIII, this is Elizabeth I, you know, and you start saying, and why are they in this state? I am a historian. How can I not do something to save these volumes? Why are they left to rot? Because literally they were left to rot in such a pitiful state that nowadays, had I not taken some, you know, video shots, people won't even believe that the archive was in such a desperate state.
Joan, absolutely, this was the case. But what is it? What is the collection about? What does it constitute?
So, they are legal documents, but they are from one particular font, collection, because they are all notarial acts. The notarial profession is a very old profession, dating back to the 13th century here in Malta, and up till today, obviously, it is still being practiced. So it is a profession that is unparalleled in any other aspect, because we have a collection that has an uninterrupted history. These volumes have kept being produced up till now, up till this very minute. So it is a very important collection when you want to do a comparative study, mm-hmm. when you want to do a study of society, of the economy of a society. Why? Because the notary was a very important person in an illiterate society. Everybody went to the notary because at par with the notary was the priest. But obviously the priest didn't have the public faith which the notary could endorse through his drawing up of the act. So the notary was a very important person, and you have all sections of society being represented. So if I want to study society really, you know, like through all its classes, I need to resort to these sources, from the slave to the farmer to the bride, to the nobleman, to the grandmaster, to the bishop, even to the viceroy of Sicily. So imagine what there is.
In essence, what are these documents if I were to open a register volume? What do they contain?
Notaries used to basically record every type of transaction or give a receipt. So if it is a dowry, if it is a sale of property, if it is the liquidation of a company, if you have the sale of a slave, so business transactions, you have wills, you have also magnificent dowries, inventories which go together with wills, and you have all of these aspects which nowadays are perhaps shared by different institutions. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, marine insurance. Mm-hmm. Today we have an institution which are the insurance brokers who are set up to do these kinds of policies, insurance policies. But before, it was the notary who took charge of all of these ways also how to manage risk. Risk not only in the sense of business, but even risk as regards certain personal agreements. Mm-hmm. He provided that personal public faith. The documents are private, mm-hmm. but they hold public faith. They can serve as evidence in court, and they are a mine of information, apart from the fact that they have went through milestones in history. You can imagine, so you have people who are recounting that there is this phobia in Malta because there is rumor of Turkish attacks throughout the ages.
So how would this be reflected in the documents? These are legal documents, they're written in legal terms,
yes,
no?
Yes.
They would still put in a story like
yes,
that?
Yes, especially the notary. Why? Because he'd say that he's fleeing the country, for example, he's going to Sicily because of this rumor, because he is afraid. So he writes this note down. When there was the earthquake of 1693, we have a whole, a whole description of what it felt like during that moment by a notary who was by the bedside of a client of his dying in the village of Imabba.
I see. So he was there to write up the will.
Yes, he was there to write down her last wishes. He had the witnesses with him. And all of a sudden, this earthquake struck. And he's writing down. He's writing down even the noises. You know, he's saying like sort of, it is like the noise of a cartoon.
Of a wheeled vehicle.
So. Yes. So, the wheels, you need to imagine that the roads weren't level at the mm-hmm. time. So the noise he must have heard, the rumbling, like thunder. And also the prayers they said to save themselves. So we know exactly which prayers were said, all right, in case that people were afraid of these things. And this is where historians come in, because historians don't only transcribe documents. Historians are there to analyze, to interpret, to read it between the lines, what, and also to read between the lines in an unbiased manner. And this is something else which I would like to say, because unfortunately in Malta, historians or history is not considered to be a scientific discipline. To be a historian, you need to go through a certain process, because, as I said, it is not just transcribing documents or recounting a tale. It is interpreting documents, mm-hmm. analyzing documents, comparing documents, contextualizing documents within the broader Mediterranean aspect. And that is what makes the difference, because Malta is not in isolation. Malta is part of something wider. The smallness of Malta makes anything happening around us, okay, being felt. Mm-hmm. That is why it doesn't have to be studied in isolation.
So you mentioned a lucky find, like the notary who had the presence of mind to recount what he was feeling during the earthquake. And I do know that at the time when you were going through the Notarial Archives collection, you used to say, every day is like Christmas at the Notarial Archives. Which were the three top finds at the Notarial Archives?
You won't believe me, but I cannot classify them. They are all so important, because that's why we said every day is Christmas, because every new find was so unique. But not unique to Malta, even unique on the international sphere. Take the Portolan chart. We found a Portolan chart. And this Portolan chart immediately struck our attention, and we said, listen.
Let me take you one back. What is a Portolan chart?
A Portolan chart is a nautical chart. Okay. Basically, seafarers use it to navigate around the Mediterranean. They used to be produced like nowadays, but nowadays we have more technical nautical charts, but before they used to be produced on paper or on parchment. And because parchment was the material used to bind volumes by law, and it was a very costly commodity, it was also very much recycled. And in fact, the Notarial collection has a number of documents which are covered with recycled parchment. And one of them is this nautical chart, a Portolan chart. And when we inquired about it, and he concluded that it is a chart produced by a very important cartographer, who is Domenico Villariolo. Now, the chart was found in a 17th century volume of notarial acts, but it actually was produced during the late 16th century, 1570s, and it is the chart of Domenico Villariolo, who was not only a cartographer, he was the cosmographer of King Philip II. Now imagine, Spain is discovering new lands in America. And you have this person who is the head of giving out licenses, okay, to navigators and also to chart makers.
So he's redrawing the world map.
He's redrawing the world map. Remarkable. And we have an example from his works. And this is one out of eight which are known in the world. There is one at Yale University. And, you know, if you look, I tried to Google and I tried to see how they keep it. And this is like, you know, it's like a treasure.
Absolutely.
And here in Malta, it was just dumped on a shelf.
Just knocking around at the Notarial Archives.
Yes,
but it's a question you probably cannot answer. How on earth did it end up in Malta?
Well, I don't know. As I said, Malta was a center for commercial activity. It could have been that a merchant needed the services of a notary, and in exchange for the service, he produced this chart. Mm-hmm. And the notary used it, you know, to bind one of his volumes. The chart is divided in two, unfortunately. So we have we have half of it missing, and the half which is missing is part of Italy and also the British Islands. Mm-hmm. But luckily, Malta is there. So, you know, we were so excited about it.
Of course.
Look, there's Malta. So we were really excited about this. That's one find that I think is of real, you know, like international caliber. And then there was another find which we were really excited about, and that was when we managed to trace a document of the presence in Malta of the 17th century painter Francesco Noletti, known as Il Maltese. Obviously, Noletti is mostly known for his still life carpets, and this find serves to substantiate also the new findings of art historians Kichi Berras and Gianluca Bocchi. So that was also an exceptional find, because it proved, you know, like that the Notarial Archives have so much to give and so much to offer. And perhaps I can say also that a personal real treasure, which I think was one of the major finds, was documents relating to Gozo. But Gozo pre-1551, when everybody is saying that there exists no documents for Gozo prior to the 1551 incursion, you know, when the whole of the population of Gozo were taken into captivity by Dragut and the documents were destroyed. During the process of sorting, we're coming across these treasures, medieval treasures from Gozo. I mean, our earliest document now is from Gozo, dating to 1430. And in it there are the customs of the Maltese, there are place names, there are things like names, nicknames. So you have how society was functioning, and these also shed an important life on the social aspect of life in Gozo, because we have things like the finding of a treasure, for example, which is really important, and also like vestments, which were ordered for the Matrice church in Rabat, and litigation processes. So they are really, really, you know, interesting documents. The wills of people from Gozo. The mention of coins, Gozitin coins. When here we thought that even Maltese coins were not minted, so we need to understand what is meant by these things. Were coins minted or not? Or was this an expression? And that is the work of the historian. Still much to do, still much to discover. But as you can see, you know, these documents span from perhaps the text, and then there is the codicological, you know, study made by the conservators. Other findings made by musicians, like when we found the secular music dating back to the 18th century, which, you know, is very rare in Malta, which Alex Vella Gregory studied, and which he also played. You know, like listening to something that hasn't been played for 200 years is awesome. Or listening to something that hasn't been sung for 500 years is also awesome.
This is all wonderful. And in fact, we had touched upon it with the very first episode of this podcast. It was Teresa Zammitlupi who was the guest at the time. And we spoke extensively about the notary archives because she was involved as head conservator at the time.
Yes. And I mean, Teresa is my right hand. So just like Francesca, I must say, you were there from the start. And you were my right and left hand. You are there always to guide me, but as well, Teresa, I mean, and she has also done some incredible finds on recycled parchment documents, especially the Liladam documents, which she discovered that actually Liladam had ordered more than the collection which we now have at St. John's. There were more liturgical works that were ordered by Liladam, and this is all thanks to Teresa's studies on our notarial collection.
It's wonderful. It really is Christmas at the notarial archives.
Yes.
Perhaps the one star find that we ought to mention, again, it was mentioned in the first episode, is the Cantilena, which was found not quite at the time when you were going through the notarial archives, but in an earlier period. Joan, let me ask you to talk to us a bit about the Cantilena. In brief, why is it such an important document? And again, why was it found in the notarial archives?
It is important because it is the earliest known literary piece in Maltese. When we thought that Maltese was a lingua talcina, you know, being only spoken by those in the lower levels of society, here we have a poet, a philosopher, who is expressing himself in Maltese.
And the date is?
And the date is prior to 1485. So it could be much earlier than 1485 because we cannot date it exactly, because this was a poem that was transcribed by another notary who was a relative of Pietro Casciaro. And this was Brandano Casciaro. Brandano Casciaro transcribed the Cantilena of Pietro Casciaro in his notarial volumes.
Why did he do this? Why include a poem in a notarial volume?
I came up with a hypothesis. We don't know exactly why. But apparently this Brandano Casciaro had a love affair with a certain Franca, whose brother was against their marriage. And I related this because if you read the poem is all about the building of a house on clay foundations. So it is a house in ruins. And I thought that perhaps this Brandano was saying this love affair of his. Mm-hmm. He gave his love, he founded his love on something which was soft, not permanent, and it is now falling down. And the Cantilena also has verses wherein the author is saying that he is going up and down the stairs in a well. And I thought, what? Is the author actually thinking of committing suicide? Why would a person go up and down the stairs of a well? So again, would Brandano be so desperate because of the lack of this love that he was thinking of committing suicide? But fortunately, the Cantilena ends with a happy note. It says that we should give life another try. We should try, you know, to look at things in another manner. That is fortunate. But I did try to come up with a hypothesis of why Brandano actually wrote it down, which is, truly a treasure. Anything after the Cantilena in Maltese is 200 years later. So imagine what a treasure we have at the archive.
It is remarkable, a remarkable find. And the fact that you are linking it to emotions which are universal, which transcend time. We can perfectly empathize with somebody who's had trouble in love,
exactly,
even now in the 21st century. And this is perhaps something that historians, at least traditionally, tended to neglect. Emotions weren't something that was serious history. It was considered a bit of a soft subject. But it's really what drives humans ultimately.
This is the new study of history. It is why before history was studied, in a more, let's call it, rigid manner. It was the history of great events, great men. Mm-hmm. Nowadays we look at history from below, especially after what we call the Annales school, the school of historians like Fernand Braudel, wherein the lower sections of societies are studied, and their actions are also thought to contribute, to have repercussions on greater events.
Okay. Now, what is your role in this archive?
At present, I am the president of the Notarial Archives Foundation. I was also a founding member of the foundation way back in 2005. The foundation seeks to generate funding in order to preserve the collection. It is a voluntary organization, and as I said, we work mostly with getting sponsors and also getting on board volunteers to help us in the preservation process. But to do this, we also need professional people, because here we are dealing with a national treasure and we cannot just, leave the collection in the hands of volunteers. So they are always supervised. That is one important aspect of the foundation.
Let's take a break to let all this sink in. This episode, originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series and now being broadcast on Campus FM, is a conversation between me, Francesca Balzan, and my guest, historian Dr. Joan Abela. And we're back. Don't forget to go to our podcast page on www.patrimonio.org to see pictures and links to what we've discussed in each podcast episode. Joan, let's go back to your academic trajectory. You won a highly competitive scholarship to read for a PhD at the University of Exeter. Now, the resulting doctoral thesis went on to win the prize for the best maritime history thesis in the United Kingdom. Now, this is a remarkable achievement. Tell me about your PhD studies and what was the subject of your thesis?
Well, the subject of my thesis was Hospital and Malta in the Mediterranean economy in the 16th century, which seems rather like a, you know, strange topic. And basically, my work examined the development of the economy of Malta and its place in the wider Mediterranean economy in the period prior to the Great Siege and also prior to the what we call the hyper-militarization of the island which followed the Great Siege. So it paints a rather complex picture of Malta and shows how Malta served as a hub of a large, complicated trading network where you had people of different faiths, Jews, Christians of various denominations, and Muslims participating in commercial activities in Malta. Imagine, in Bergo especially. So from notarial documents, I could establish that these merchants were using well-developed instruments of trade. And in place, there was also a commercial, you know, like framework, the law permitted, all right, the support of this network, which is amazing.
So what you're saying, are you saying there were banks, there were insurances, there were legal instruments for sending money abroad, for example?
Well, you need to think of banks, not as the institutions we know them today. Banks were, at times, the notaries themselves. Banks were the money changer. That's the word bank comes from bancos, the table where the money changer placed the coins and where, you know, like he did his transactions. So yes, in Malta there were these instruments, these financial instruments, which permitted trade and which also ultimately provided opportunities for the Maltese, and the knights also served as a pull factor. So in my work, I also established that there was this economic boom as exactly on the arrival of the knights, because the knights were a pull factor.
So we're talking about 1530, when the Knights of the Order of St. John arrive in Malta and take over the governance of our islands, up till 1565, when the Great Siege occurs and the Ottoman Turks arrive and attack Malta, which is a big and important historical landmark for us. And this was a period which was not really well studied or well known. Joan, it seems that you were the first to really examine this period from an economic point of view, from obviously the history point of view, social history perhaps. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, well, actually I tried to build on other important work like that of Carmel Kassar. But yes, I think I was the first to actually look at this period through legal documents. And I tried to demonstrate also certain aspects like the grain trade, and that this was not, you know, the only important economic activity, but there were other wider range of goods, including the sale and ransoming of slaves. We need to look at Malta as the center for human trafficking. And ransom processes were very important, and this is in line with current studies wherein historians have established that ransoming was such an important part of the motor of economy that they are now calling it the economy of ransom. And imagine having this island, this tiny island of Malta, as a center for human trafficking. And we have the documents to prove it, which is so exceptional.
It really is. But Joan, in the light of recent events, like, of course, the world changing Black Lives Matter, which really shone light on the fact that so many people were exploited to build empires and to build trade networks and all that, how do you feel about all this? Should our history be perhaps looked at again through modern eyes. Perhaps we shouldn't glorify the fact that we had such a huge slave market in Malta.
Well, I don't think that we are actually glorifying. This is a fact. Mm-hmm. And this is our work. Mm-hmm. We need to accept the fact that slavery, obviously, the making of a slave, not of a co-religionist, but of an infidel. Mm-hmm. From both sides, was something that was accepted. It was also accepted by the church. So that's why when we study these things, we need to look back and understand the mentality at the time.
In 2018, you were made a member of the National Order of Merit by the government of Malta for your role in promoting and preserving Malta's paper heritage. What did this feel like? I mean, does it actually help in your uphill struggle to make paper heritage a national priority?
Yes, it did, because I think I felt that the awareness which we were trying to create finally arrived at the core.
Now, Joan, I think anybody listening to this podcast will be convinced that you're an effortless public speaker. And you're a university lecturer in the Faculty of Laws at the University of Malta. But you're not a lawyer. How is it that you're lecturing in that department? And what subjects do you cover when you give lectures there?
I lecture at the Faculty of Laws because I give lectures in legal history and research methods to students from the course in notarial studies. They are master degree students, and basically I try to instill in them this love for the archives. We need to remember that these students might in future take up important positions, even political or other important positions that may also ultimately reflect upon decisions which are being taken as regards our paper heritage. So I make it a point to take them to the archives. We have a whole credit on fieldwork. So they actually go and dig up the documents, and they also are now creating a database. We work at the Banca Giuratale in Rabat, and hopefully this database will be available to the general public and will also serve as a tool for anybody wanting to study legal documents held at the Banca Giuratale, which I think is a great thing. And I always tell my students, now, as soon as you finish the course, and when you go, you know, for a coffee and you stroll past by the Banca Giuratale, I am sure that these lovely memories of the archives and, you know, our exciting conversations while we find an exciting document will come to mind. And you'll tell your children, look, that building there holds some exceptional, you know, information. And this is something which is really, really close to my heart, because that is something which I want to do. I want to give Malta students that accept the fact that, listen, we need to work to preserve our heritage, and we should not be passive about it.
So you lecture them in legal history, but your cunning plan is really to get them to fall in love with archives.
Exactly. I also believe that a university's function is not just to produce professionals who are limited to their area of study and whose driving principles circumvent on personal success. A university degree should ensure that these students are made to believe that they can be the creators of change. Change for a better world.
Joan, you're not only a tireless campaigner, but you remain first and foremost a historian. What is your main research focus at the moment?
My main research focus at the moment is, let's say, it's torn between two different centuries, because I am doing some research on women and their legal persona, especially as regards dotal rights. And this is a very interesting topic, since a lot of new material is coming out as regards the local context vis-a-vis other European countries, wherein Maltese women are being found to have more legal rights than their counterparts, for example, in Britain.
Okay, so what period is this, and what do you mean by dotal rights?
The period I'm covering is the 16th century, and by dotal rights I mean that part of the inheritance which is given to the daughter for her marriage. So you have different instances, you have different types of contracts which regulate this donation. And through the study of these different contracts, ultimately we can come up with a comparative approach between Malta and other countries. My secondary research focuses on feminism. I'm doing a credit on feminism at the moment, and I'm doing a lot of research on it, and I go back to the times of Christine de Pizan, basically from the different waves of feminism, first, second, third, and fourth, which is very exciting, very, very exciting.
So in total, what periods are you covering there?
There I'm going from the 13th century up till nowadays. And I'm not saying that feminism existed in the, 14th century, but it's just that there were women who advocated for their rights at the time, not in the form of the feminist thought we know today. That was something much later.
Joan, every society and every generation has its preconceptions about the past. And yet, when we dig below the surface, we occasionally find that they're wrong. Now, what preconceptions were you able to challenge and change thanks to your research?
First and foremost, the preconception that Malta was a desert in 1530. So we see that Malta has already, as I said, established financial institutions. There were merchants, very wealthy ones. There was, even the town council, which was a semi-autonomous one. So there are certain conceptions that Malta was a barren island. But again, I looked at it from a different point of view, and I tried to look at the Sicilian context, especially the studies of Stephen Epstein, a very important economic historian, and I took his model and tried to project his model on Malta. Now, Stephen Epstein said that the backwardness with which we look at Sicily is sometimes prejudiced. Why? Because Sicilian farmers were opting to produce niche products. And the same thing is found happening in Malta. When we say that Malta doesn't have enough wheat to produce or to feed its own people, I found that in actual fact, Maltese farmers are opting not to produce wheat, but to produce goods like cumin, cotton, which we call niche products. Why? Because they are yielding in more profits, and they required less land area to produce, and they were good for the balance of payments. And another thing was the participation of women in business affairs, which is very important. Women never had a voice in history, especially in Maltese history. And I tried to give them a voice. I tried to make them participant in economic activities. Women were not part of our historical narrative. I'm not saying that women were such a strong movement that anything political or anything financial was in their hands.
No, that would be fiction. That would be overemphasizing a role which was not.
What I'm saying is that women were there. They were there when their husbands went abroad and took over the administration of the household and of the business, and they are issuing receipts, they are making contracts on behalf of their husbands, which ultimately need to be ratified. But women are there. So that's a very important aspect to look at, which has been ignored.
Joan, the earlier you go, the documents are fragmentary and they can be difficult to read. How did you train yourself to read this paleography, this writing, and what languages are they written in?
The documents are written, mostly the ones I study, at least, are written in a corrupt, we call it, type of Latin. It's called legal Latin, because it's a Latin full of abbreviations, and it's not the classical Latin. It's very difficult to read for that main reason. So in order to try to, break this code, I used a lot the works of Professor Stanley Fiorini, who issued a set of publications called Document Resources for Maltese History. And I used to go to the archives, and I used to take, this published work with me, get the original volume, and see exactly the form of the letters, how they are deciphered. It's a long process. I am still, in the learning process, because each handwriting needs a new study. And you only feel that you're starting to feel confident about what you're reading after many, many years of looking at documents. And still today, I give my work to other colleagues, so that I ensure that I am reading exactly what I am interpreting in the documents.
Mm-hmm. I know that you've also traveled extensively to research in various archives. Just give us a flavor. Which archives were the most compelling, the most quirky? I mean, had the most intriguing collections?
Well, the Istanbul State Archives were, I think, the most impressive, as I had the privilege to see some of the most beautiful 16th century state treaties between the Ottoman Empire and the European monarchs. Also, the documents depicting the two Grauages, the cipher of the Ottoman Sultan, especially that of Suleiman the Magnificent, which is amongst the most beautiful. So that, was really something awesome. Wow. It's something I'll never forget. But the most compelling and intriguing were the State Archives of Palermo, especially the Sede Gancha, which is part of the State Archives of Palermo, where the notarial registers of Palermo are kept. I was also very lucky to go do research there with Professor Stanley Fiorini, a mentor like that, by your side. You just have a difficulty and you ask him. And we looked at the documents of the Cancelleria, and which are chancery documents, and the proto notario. Proto is head, so it's the head notary. And we tried to look at anything which contained the word Malta or referred to Malta. Now, that was an exhilarating experience, which I will never forget. And there are also, like the State Archives of Venice, which I also had the honor to do research with my tutor, Professor Maria Fusaro, again, a mine of information. I need to say this anecdote about the State Archives of Venice now. They are housed at the Convent of the Frari. And this convent has a church, and I used to go to hear Mass daily before going to the archive, before going to do research. But I used to go because this was such a beautiful church, having paintings of Tiziano, a monument for Canova. And, you just stayed there and looked in awe around you. And this was nourishment for my soul, it used to fill me with so much joy, to see so much beauty, literally by going to hear a 30-minute mass. So I'll never forget that as well. And then there were also the secret Vatican archives, which I had the pleasure to visit together with Teresa Zammitlupi, and it's thanks to her that we managed to have a glimpse inside these archives, which are also so very exceptional. I am very lucky to have had friends and colleagues who were always open and who also shared my interests and encouraged me.
Joan, many years ago you were a member of the Heritage Advisory Board within the Planning Authority. Yet recently you have been highly critical of planning decisions and the destruction of old buildings. Tell me what it is you're angry about.
Well, I am so, so angry that we have literally permitted the destruction of our once enchanting villages by allowing insensitive and out-of-scale buildings. This sprawling development has eradicated the boundaries which separate one village from another. Our church domes shadowed or even covered by tall buildings. You know, the church should be the highest building because it had a significance. You look up towards the heavens. But what is more heartbreaking is the demolition of so many vernacular buildings, especially the humble dwellings, which were testimony to the way of life of our ancestors. What is also very sad, Fran, is that this destruction is institutionalized. Unfortunately, the members appointed on planning boards are politically appointed and have no sound background in urban planning or any appreciation of our architectural heritage. No, I have to say it. It seems that they are there to facilitate the process for speculators. And such situations make me angry, very angry, because I feel helpless. I believe that, as a nation, we should not only look at the economic benefits of the building industry, Fran. We should also take into account the repercussions of the overbuilding, the repercussions of these on the quality of our life, and how this will ultimately create an impact and affect future generations.
Joan, finally, if you were to dream, what is your ideal for the notarial archives? What do you want it to be?
Well, my dream is that the archives open up as a center of excellence. I always say this, as a center of excellence. I say this with, you know, feeling like a great burden upon me, because this thing of excellence, ultimately, you know, you have something to be accountable for. But yes, I want it to be a center of excellence in conservation and in multidisciplinary research, that it may serve as an inspiration for different forms of artistic expressions. Imagine how beautiful this would be, Fran. You're both a historian and an artist. Wouldn't it be lovely to have a place where you could, you know, join in with these two lovers of yours together? That is something which I really like. I also want that the place, the building, becomes a social space where academics, artists, and all those who love the arts can meet, you know, on a regular basis, having a drink there, you know, provide them with that space where they can share their findings, their projects, their ideas. Imagine what a wonderful atmosphere. That's what I would like for the archives.
On that happy, hopeful note, I'm going to close off the podcast, but not before thanking you so much, Joan, not only for your time today and for your friendship over many, many years, but also for the huge contribution you have given to our heritage, and most especially your militant attitude in preserving our heritage and in fighting laissez-faire attitudes. Thank you for listening to this episode of Treasures from Malta on Campus FM. This was originally recorded as a podcast, and there are pictures and links to all we've discussed on the Fondazione Patrimonio Malti website under the podcast section. That's www.patrimonio.org.